This podcast is from heptagonclub.co.uk and paulcarenza.com. The Heptagon Club.
Heptagon Club.
Heptagon Club with Paul Carenza. 7 guests, 7 corners.
On this week's show,
I've brought a megaphone. Just
very good.
Is everyone having a good time?
What?
Yep.
Is a pixie's favourite drink?
If I ever do Graham Norton again, shall I
crowbar that one in?
And your host,
Mr. Paul Carenza.
Hello, podcast listeners. My name is Paul Carenza. Welcome to the Heptagon Club. I hope your Christmases have been merry. Happy New 2017 to you. May it be full of hope and whatever we need to get through it, basically. We have many, many comedians for you this week. What a show we have. Most have been not with us before, but this is the Tim Vine episode. Lots of Tim this week. Plus co-short joke merchant Milton Jones, plus Sally Phillips, plus Miranda Hart. And for the Milton and Sally chat, we really have to thank Premier Christianity magazine for arranging that. You can read a transcript of bits of our chat in their January issue. And indeed, they have a podcast too, so have a Google. We've also got a comedian this week you may not be familiar with if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, Father Chris Bedding from Perth, Australia. He's a priest and a comedian. We've also got my good friend Henry Kendall, ever opinionated, with, I guess, a mix of, fashion advice and Star Trek reminiscence. We'll go with that. And my wife will be making her debut on this podcast. We've had both of my kids on early episodes. So to complete the set, the final voice in my house to be featured, apart from Siri, I suppose. So that should total 7, I think, because that's what we aim for here. 7 guests, 7 corners of the club, and you are most welcome. Just sort of stand in the middle of the club and you'll be able to hear all of the conversations buzzing around you. Beginning this week with Mr. Tim Vine.
I think you have the shortest name on the comedy circuit, I think.
Ha! Well, that's an interesting thought.
And if your name was longer, would you have written longer jokes?
Well, no is the answer.
Fair enough.
No, I'm not. No,
I'm overthinking it.
Yeah, I think possibly. Yeah. The advantage is the letters can be bigger on a poster.
That's true.
Your name's Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yes.
His show's never really.
No. Yeah.
People had to get too near the poster to see who was on. A couple of Christmases ago, I had a joke book out, and the publishers had made these joke crackers which had my jokes in them, so
right,
they had these little boxes, so I took some of them to at Christmas Day, and everyone they sort of took out the cracker, and with all the family and the nieces and nephews, and everyone they read out, I thought, God, that's rubbish, isn't it? And my brother went, God, that's rubbish. I said, these are mine. He said, oh, sorry. It was like, but it was like the ones they'd chosen, I hadn't got to choose the ones that were in the...
Oh, I see. So they just went for them, yeah.
One of them I remember being just like a sentence, really.
Right.
But my act's a bit like a sentence.
Is there... Well, you get less for murder.
If you've not already listened, I recommend our earlier episodes. Well, of course, I would say that, with Miranda and Sally and Milton taking centre stage in those ones. Subscribe on iTunes if you've not already, or join our Facebook group, and we will throw info at you about them. This, I think, actually is my favourite episode, and if you agree, we now have a donate button on our webpage. That's the webpage version, not the iTunes version of this podcast, so heptagonclub.co.uk. There is a little donate button if you're so willing. But more of that later. Also, news later of our finite future of this podcast. We've got one more episode this series, basically, and then we're going to be back later in the year for series 2.
So a world record holder as well of...
Yes, in fact, if you were in my house, I'd tell you to turn around now.
Where
are you?
See... Well, you brought it with you.
I brought it with me, the certificate. Here
frame it,
is.
On our wall here. That's lovely, yeah. 499 jokes in 1 hour. Wow.
That's right, yeah. So, but it's one thing I have a slight problem with that certificate is that it doesn't actually say world record holder, it just says certificate. You told 499 jokes in 1 hour in front of a live paying audience. As if to say, well done, but anybody want a medal?
We should all have one of those after every gig.
Just to say what we've done with our lives.
You told some jokes, very good indeed, yeah. How do you begin to, because that was without notes, was it?
Essentially it was. Although I did have, I heard that you're allowed 20 words as cues.
Okay.
So I thought to myself, right, well, I've got my existing act, and I'll, just to bump up the numbers a bit, I'll write down 20 words.
okay.
in preparation, and for each word will lead me to another two jokes.
Right.
So I thought to myself, right, that card there, that's worth 40 jokes. So I just went to it, you know, at one point. But there is a little bit of a, it's a bit of a grey area to do with whether or not you can read it or not, because I think some people have read their jokes. And,
oh, I see. Oh, really?
Or at least some people have had endless cue cards.
Yes, yes.
I think I've heard that the current world record is held by someone in India. And, I mean, I don't know, I've not seen it, but whether or not he read it, I don't know.
And would that be not in English? Would that be in...
Well, that's a good point, yeah. I went to a jumble sale in India. It was a Bring Mumbai. There we are. Now, of course, if you were at the Guinness Book of Records and you were sent a tape of someone doing an entire... an hour of jokes in Punjabi, you probably would just assume from the laughs after it that these were jokes.
True.
Whether or not you'd get someone to check the whole thing. I know they didn't, I don't think they did anyway, check my thing entirely, because mine was filmed and then we gave them the tape to check, you know. But on the night, because it's not always clear exactly how many jokes it is. Now, some people said I did over 500. Some people said I did. So most people who were counting, we had about five different people counting, and they all came up with different numbers.
Of course. Have you got a topper on a joke? Is it sort of...
Yeah, exactly. So is that two or not? I ate this chess set. It was horrible. I took it back to the shop. I said, "That's stalemate." He said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Checkmate." Now, is that two jokes
two,
or one?
Two,
sounds
it?
Like
yeah,
two, doesn't it? But some people might think that was one. But anyway, so we went with the one person who had the conservative estimate of 499 is what we went with. Mm. And then the Guinness Book of Records said, 499, and I thought, they've not watched all of that.
It sounds like a good number, doesn't it? If they said 500, they would
have
said
that. Yeah, exactly.
499 sounds quite specific. I wonder as well, you know, if you watch a subtitled film, and if you watch it, say it's German.
Yes, it's German.
It's German. Thank you. I'm glad you did. I can read the subtitle. I've got a lot longer to read the subtitles because they're quite long words in German.
Yes.
If I watch a French subtitle, you hardly got time because it's quite a speedy language.
Is that right? I've never noticed that.
I think so. Or Italian or something is quite speedy. I just wonder if you had an Italian comic trying to break this record or a French comic or something, it might be easier than a Finnish comedian where the words are 12 syllables long. I don't know. I don't know how English measures with the other languages on.
Yeah, well, I've never thought about the competition that was coming from other languages.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's an Olympic sport now, you see. They're all entering this, you know.
I did think of a joke yesterday that may or may not. Now I'm here with you, as you write great jokes, you can tell me whether or not you think this would get a laugh of an audience. Of course, there's no way of knowing,
there's no way of knowing.
But I thought it was quite contrived, which I quite like.
Right, okay.
Over-contrived.
I like contrived, okay.
So I said to... hang on a minute. This bloke said to me, he said, I'm going to put you in a bunker underneath the Germanic state that was abolished by the Nazis in 1934.
Right.
Actually, beneath, not underneath. It was about, and I said, I'm no good under Prussia. I'm no good under Prussia.
I love it.
I'm not sure whether have people even heard of Prussia.
Yeah, anymore? I know. You need a handout before some of these, don't you? Just to make sure they get the things. Yeah,
We do have it's a bit of a catchphrase on tour, actually, between, when we're on tour, the three of us in a van, and I'll come up with something, and the tour manager will sort of mutter, "Another modern reference." Okay. All my references seem to be sort of either 1970s or the 1930s. You know, I find I do go towards the decade you like the best is kind of... I really like the 70s. I have a great deal of, sort of nostalgia for the 70s. So, I'd like to do an entire hour on Charlie's Angels, Starsky and Hutch and the $6 Million Man.
There you go.
But then it would look too much like, you know, Who Remembers Spangles, wouldn't it?
You could do that.
I've seen Tim Vine going to clubs and things, and it's rare that we're on the same bill, but... You know, just change atmospheres.
And this change of atmosphere comes from Milton Jones, who is with Sally Phillips. We have to thank Premier Christianity magazine for helping us wrangle them along to the club, where Milton, delightfully, wants to talk about Tim.
It changes the type of laughter, actually, in terms of a sweary old act in front of stag nights doing a certain type of joke. There's an aggression to the laughter. Then Tim comes on, and there's 30 seconds while everyone's thinking, what's going on? Mm-hmm. These are just jokes. And he's putting cartoons in people's heads. And you know, the way he relentlessly hammers it. No, you're not stopping, are you? hammering. And you can tell if you just listen to the laughter without the jokes, you go, this is different laughter. this is more than just people laughing at people being rude to other people. This is putting, to my mind, it's a higher level. And if I can achieve that in some way, and it doesn't have to have a message, it doesn't have to be a Tim Vine type joke, but if I can lift people to a place that's better than where they were, then that's still worth doing. It doesn't have to have a great big message.
Milton Jones and Sally Phillips.
And I think this is really interesting, and I'm not going to be able to explain why. But there's something, I mean, I had a similar experience going to watch Miranda Hart's show. When I went to see her live show, and I saw three generations of family, grandparents, parents, and kids, all there together, and I heard her from the stage going, "You are fearfully and wonderfully made." And I thought, this is me telling you that you are acceptable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just the release of people having someone at the, like a, you know, a major general of the, doesn't matter if you fart, doesn't matter if you fall over on in the middle of the street.
I've got a little burp coming.
Go for it, enjoy, live the dream.
Doesn't matter if you go into a shop and you don't intend to buy anything, you don't have to pretend you're going to buy anything, just exit. You know, take down your masks. The freedom that people were feeling from having someone saying that was so immense. Yeah. And
which is why it's really hard to get somebody like that commissioned.
Yeah.
Because commissioners, I think, you know, I'm danger of going down a negative alley, but in terms of commissioners reading scripts, they won't by and large see that.
No.
It's like the success, I mean, it's a different thing entirely, but Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Yeah.
In many ways, we're all shrugging, going, well, what? How did that get on? Yeah. How did... But you can't, you know, in terms of response, it's
you can't
huge.
Deny the response, yeah. Mm. And I think it is that thing of preaching a message. I don't, when I say that, I don't mean Mark Thomas.
Yeah.
I don't mean it, because I actually think that becomes very narrow, because you're telling everyone what all the different things mean. Mm. Whereas actually Tim Vine is, as you say, I mean, he is changing something, but not by telling anyone he's changing anything.
Yeah.
And Miranda as well, not by... There's a worldview there that's informing how people feel and how they live their lives in lots of cases. And with Miranda, there's so many teenage girls who are acting it out. And
I think part of it, there's a vulnerability to it, and you've suddenly got a leader or someone who's talking who's showing a vulnerability, and people really respond to that. Whereas a lot of aggressive comedy... A, it's not vulnerable in any way because it, you know, it's bulletproof, and it's attacking soft targets. Whereas neither Miranda or Tim are doing that.
And here on episode 6 of 7 is Miranda.
Someone told me the other day about how the phrase sixes and sevens came about.
Oh, I don't know this.
And now I can't remember.
Oh, neither do
you. Never retain facts. Something about the livery companies.
Okay.
And they had a rowing race. Oh, no, I can't remember. It's one of my best anecdotes. I think they had a list of the livery companies 1 to 10, and then 6 overtook 7, and there was a whole argument in the race.
Oh,
and
really?
And they were all 6 to 7s. As I say, that's one of my best anecdotes.
That's a good...
If I ever do Graham Norton again, shall I
crowbar
that
one in?
Total winner.
Which is always nice, that Graham will keep tee you up for that one.
Yeah,
will
tee
be like,
me up for that
so,
one.
So Miranda,
yeah.
I hear that you've got some information about sixes and sevens.
Well, I might even not mention it to him. I might just throw it, you know.
Nice,
might be there with Russell Coe talking about his
the
latest wife or something. And I'd say, just out of interest, just do you know where the phrase, Russell, sixes and sevens comes from?
You should interrupt him halfway through one of his anecdotes.
One of his really strong anecdotes. Hopefully heartfelt ones.
Yeah.
Revealing quite something quite...
You should do that and just walk off then. That's it. This cannot be bettered. Yeah.
The Heptagon Club.
7 guests, 7 corners. The Heptagon Club with Paul Carenza.
Back at the party. I've brought a megaphone. Just
very, very good.
Is everyone having a good time?
I'm glad someone brought that. You know, if they'd all brought it, it would be quite frustrating. Darts. You love darts, don't you?
I do love darts, yeah.
Yes. That was all I have on darts.
Yeah, no. Well, I've got it. We could have a game when... if you're at my house.
Hey, well, conveniently, the Heptagon Club has a dartboard.
Oh, maybe fantastic. We'll have a... I've got a darts joke.
Oh, yeah.
I saw Phil the Power Taylor came up to me. He said, how come you put super glue on one of my darts? I said, you just can't let it go, can you? I've changed it. It's the first time I've told it was Phil the Power Taylor. Normally it's Eric Bristow. I was just aware of wanting a modern reference.
I've heard of Eric Bristow.
Oh, right, we haven't heard of Phil the Power Taylor.
Exactly. Oh, that would have worked.
Typical, right.
That would have worked. That's hilarious.
Stick with the modern references.
Obviously, you know, good quick jokes is your forte. But people ask about, you know, do you know what your shortest joke is? Is it by a word count or anything?
Because
things like, you know, I've got the sponge door, don't knock it, must be seven. Well, you must be the shortest jokes of all time.
Velcro, what a rip off is quite short, isn't it? Velcro, what a rip off. That's five.
Rip off is hyphenated as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I used to do a thing where I'd take out some garden shears out of a prop box, and I hold them up, and then I go, shears, and I put them down again.
That is with a prop.
And
yeah.
A prop is
a word of itself.
It's, yeah, a thousand words.
It's a thousand and one words.
It's a thousand and one word joke, so it doesn't count at all.
So that doesn't quite work. Yeah, so that's probably your longest
that's
joke.
That's my longest ever joke. Fair enough.
Is there a longest bit you've ever done? Is there a long story or anything? Or
I did a long story.
I'm asking you to read it now for the next half hour. But how long do you go for?
Difficult to say. Though, I usually think if it's longer than three lines, it's not me.
Right.
It depends how big the font is, of course. I've done sort of Shaggy Dog stories, but there have always been gags in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a bit like eating. When you set off quickly, the pace you begin with, it's really hard to slow it down.
Yes.
So, I mean, where short bits have worked for me is on TV and things, because you can go bang, 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 and you're in, and you're out. You've chucked a grenade and got out quickly. And that's great. And if you're a long storyteller, it's much harder. Mm. But then doing an hour and a half show, that's a lot of jokes.
Of course.
So that's what I find harder, to pace things.
When it's things like Mock the Week, then is it fair to say that it seems like you are doing something completely different to the others, or is it not as simple as that? Is it sort of? It looks like you're almost doing a different show.
In a way, I'm not a team player.
Right.
You know, I've said before, but it's one of them will say one of them will say two, one of them will say three, and I'll say pheasant.
Right, okay.
And there's a lot of, you know, just going clunk. But actually, this is my excuse, is that the editors quite like that, because it's good to have something like that to end on.
It's punctuation.
It's punctuation. Yeah. That's the only reason I do it.
It's good, of course.
Yes,
it's good
to help them out.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, to be honest, when I was first asked to do it, I thought, is this the show for me, really? I'm not sure. But I've seen Stuart Francis do that. And I thought, well, if he can do it, then maybe I might be able to. And yes, a lot of what I do is preformed or half formed before I do it. But I think, if anything, it's worked for me because I'm not doing what the others are doing. And it's just given a bit of variety. I think Mock the Week serves comedians quite well insofar as, would you really want to see half an hour of any one of those all at once?
Okay, yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah.
And then, us all doing little bits. It's sort of a bit like a buffet where you're having, you know, your cheese and then your meat and then your potatoes or whatever it is, isn't it? And mixing it up a bit.
So from Mock the Week to another panel show, Would I Lie to You? Now, my wife has a brilliant theory on Would I Lie to You? She's really good at spotting these things. And it would be rude not to have her here now. Hello, my wife!
Hello.
What's your theory on Would I Lie to You?
It's not that brilliant.
It's brilliant. It is brilliant. What is your theory?
Although I'm right most times. It's that when the guest comes in.
Right, so this is the... This is mine.
This is
mine. This is mine.
They know someone. So one of the panel knows someone.
And one tells the truth and the other two lie, don't they?
Yes.
So it's kind of which is telling the truth.
Yeah.
And you have got it right every time. We've seen probably every episode, I think.
Well, you see, I can tell by their body language who knows the person who comes in, because they look down. And this is before anyone even says anything. They've literally just walked in.
They look down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They look away from the person as they come in, and everyone else looks at them because they don't know who's going to come through the door, so they're looking around expecting.
So they're being polite. It's the first time you're meeting them.
But they're also being interested in what's happening, the person who knows the person
looks away
because they think. No, it's not guilt. It's just that they know who it is. There's no surprise.
Do you not think they're deliberately covering it up, though? Is there a bit of like, if I don't look at them, we won't exchange eye contact?
Yeah, there's a bit of that. There's a bit of that, I think, Very interesting, but it generally works.
It does. I don't think you've ever got it wrong.
Well, maybe once or
maybe
twice.
Once or twice. But mostly,
when everyone looks down, but that's very
that's true. They all just, oh, don't like the look of that person. And also, because it's well, not the same thing, but murder mysteries, you generally get murder mysteries right.
Yeah, but that's for different reasons.
But it's still reading people, isn't it? It's still, and like Usual Suspects, you got it within 90 seconds of it starting.
Well, that was obvious.
Yeah, well, here's what's happened here.
I knew exactly who
and then it was 90 minutes of you saying, I told you, I told you, I told you.
I eat badly a lot. Do you have to make a real effort to not eat bad? Do you eat, you know, on the road?
You have all the best intentions to begin with, and someone could actually make a killing if they had hot, healthy food available at service stations.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's always hot and unhealthy, isn't it?
11 o'clock at night would be ideal. Yeah.
Yes, yes. I mean, I guess we eat at unhealthy times. But it, I mean, it probably doesn't hurt to do that occasionally. It's when you're on a long night after night binge, or if you were at a hotel, there was a cooked breakfast.
Yeah, yeah.
And even if you're doing, you know, a nice tour, there'll be people to see afterwards for a drink. Mm. It's just one unhealthy marathon, and where you put on weight. So, and then also in that same regime, it's very difficult to do regular exercise.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So it all compounds itself. And then you have to do a crash afterwards.
That's true, that's true.
So no, I don't think there is an answer. Yeah, unless you have your own private chef. That's
I've done some comedian car shares where they actually, some really, particularly ones nowadays who are starting out with career plans and five-year plans.
Oh yeah,
and,
dear. Yeah.
You know, and they bring this freshly home-prepared organic pitcher in the back seat and it's big bag of apples. I think this isn't the spirit, come
no,
on.
No, quite. It doesn't endear yourself to anyone else, does it?
Put it next to the KFC bag.
As wife of a comedian, as a comedy widow, as we call them, you, is there any hope? How can comedians eat well on the road?
Eat nuts.
Eat nuts. Thanks. Same to you.
you can cook something healthy, like a stew, or you can get your wife to do it, like you do, and then put it in a warming device, like a thermos.
Yes.
Or for lower maintenance snacks, you can just eat cheese and salami. Yeah,
but you can't have a gig.
Nuts.
It's 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. Everyone's closed. You've not any dinner.
Okay. You like kebabs.
I like a kebab.
Eat the kebab, but don't eat the chips.
Eat the kebab, but not the chips.
Yeah.
So a nice doner meat.
And no sauce.
Nice doner meat in a naan bread. Lots of mild chilli. Oh.
You can have the chilli, just not the sugary bit.
Okay.
And then you'll lose weight in no time.
Okay, thanks. It's become a lecture very quickly.
You did ask.
All right, fair enough.
There's someone like Leon or someone like that. Do you know the chain, which is mainly in London? You can get quite nice healthy food, but how often do you want healthy food?
I never feel like it at 11 o'clock at night after a gig, do you?
No, you can only have chicken salad so many times.
Yes.
And then you need something. And also, I don't know about you, when I'm away and working, I look forward to food and drink too much.
True, yeah.
And so it becomes a highlight.
Yes.
And therefore you eat more than you should.
I also used to find that if I had a good gig or a really good gig, I'd think I'm going to reward myself.
Yes.
That would feel great. I'm going to have a big sloppy kebab pizza.
Yes.
And then if I have a bad gig, I think, oh, I need to feel better about myself. I need to go and eat a big sloppy kebab pizza. So it's just the middle 10% where I think actually I now just feel like a chicken salad.
Yes, no, I never, ever feel like a chicken salad.
No, that doesn't ever really happen, does it?
Just done this show, Tim Timony, Tim to You, which was a stand-up show. And I kind of, partly probably because I'm sort of shying away from having to write another one, I've been really doing it... flogging it for all it's worth. I think I've done it about 110 times. But it's you know, as long as people keep coming to watch it, I suppose that means people want to watch it.
I like to think you've got a big list somewhere of all your future touring show titles. You know, the
well, I thought there have been a few Panorama. That one never got used.
Okay.
I thought Panorama would be good up against. Because Jeremy at the time was my brother Jeremy was hosting Panorama, and so I remember being at one of these meetings where TV people look at you clearly thinking about something else, and I said, I've got this idea for a show, Panorama. You put it on the same time as Panorama, and you know, the PR writes itself. And they said, "What's it about?" And I said, "Well," I said, "Never mind that."
Yeah, exactly. Panorama, come on.
People, in fact, the Tim Timony, Tim to You, James Acaster came up.
Oh, really?
That for me,
really?
Yeah. We were in Melbourne Comedy Festival, and I was being chased for a title, and I had Panorama as a possibility, and also Scottish Independence was another.
Oh, very good.
Because at the time, but they both sounded a bit too, like they might be political, you know, so.
I've always quite like the. Have you seen Joe Lycett's Showtime?
Oh yeah, no, I like them. Yeah.
That's the way. Aha.
Joe Lycett. Yeah. No, I like that a lot.
That's very good. I'd be remiss of me not to mention, speaking of Edinburgh festivals and things, the year that you didn't go but sent a poster of yourself.
Oh yeah, yeah, 2006.
Was it? Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
So the poster was saying Tim Vine.
It basically said, yeah, it said Tim Vine. It was very, very big. I think the scale of the poster was the main attraction for me. It was this enormous thing, about the size of the side of a bus.
It was big. Yeah. It was. Did you ever even see it? Because you weren't up there.
I didn't see it live. No, I saw photos of it.
I saw it daily as a nice reminder of walking to my venue
that I was lying in.
Exactly. I know. Thinking I should have not been here this year. That would have been a great idea.
Yeah, it actually cost about $4,000, I think.
Yeah. How did you go from the... So you had that idea. Did you
Year before. I was there the year before.
Right.
And Ahmed Jalili had that poster site.
Oh, yeah.
And it was so vast. Mm. And I said to a promoter who also promoted Ahmed, I said, look at that. That's enormous. Please can I bagsy that for next year, that poster? And he said, yeah, you're right. And I sort of bagsed it, and then I didn't have a show.
Right, I see.
I don't know how we ended up going, well, let's put a poster up anyway. I don't quite know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was going to be, I was going to do a whole slight nod to Al Murray, actually, with it, because it was going to say, Tim, gentlemen, please.
Right.
And a white vine for the ladies, or something like
that. Very good. Yes, yeah.
How do you decide? Whether you decide to think to yourself, I've got to write something else.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, the thing is with me, because I've not got a fan base. I have no one who watches me on stage, basically.
Nah.
So, but as a result, I'm just doing, you know, my shows are new to whoever's there.
But how do you decide when if you're going to get a new show for Edinburgh? Which way around do you do it? Do you say, all right, I'll do Edinburgh and then start panicking and write the show? Or do you go, oh, I've got a show here, but I take it to Edinburgh?
I suppose I leave it long enough that both have sort of happened.
Right.
You know,
okay.
I haven't done it every year for a while now.
Yeah.
And I went this year, but I won't go for 2 years now just to get enough stuff for a show.
Yeah.
But
you went this year?
I did go just the first 10 days.
Right. Great.
And it
I think I know that because we probably exchanged texts. Now I think of it.
But it was. I think it's going to be all or nothing. It felt like leaving a party early. You know,
yeah.
10 days. So.
That must be. Yeah, it's weird going for the first 10 as well.
Well, I partly did that because I knew that you go in the last 10, you get tempted to all the parties and stuff.
Well, that's it. I suppose then it really does feel like you're leaving a party.
Well, true. Yeah.
At the same time as everyone else.
Mm. Exactly. Arriving.
Arriving late.
Yes.
That's probably worse. But it's probably better to arrive late at a party and leave with everyone else than it is to arrive at the same time and leave early.
True. Yeah, although I did quite enjoy that smug feeling of going, right, bye-bye now, everybody.
Have fun
with your lost voices now.
And, yeah.
That was quite nice.
Yeah, because 10 days is right smack in the middle, isn't it?
Yeah.
Everyone is in that no man's land of they can't see the end or the beginning.
Absolutely. Yeah. Good luck to you. We went home, had a holiday, came back, people are still there. So
yeah.
It was a bit like that. But no, I've got a love-hate relationship with Edinburgh.
I have as well.
I think I love it more than it loves me, but it's one of those you think, I keep coming back.
That's Tim Vine on the Edinburgh Festival, and this is Miranda Hart.
Would you go back to Edinburgh Fringe, ever?
I flip between, yes, it'd be fun, because it's a wonderful creative hub, and you can be experimental and be surrounded by fabulous people, but flip side, it's sort of exhausting in a way that's kind of indescribable, isn't it? It's an assault on the senses. You see, I'm a real introvert, so I realise now why I found it so sapping.
Right,
just
yes.
Just constant people. And,
it is full on, isn't it?
Yeah. So I'd probably like to go and visit for 5 days, see some stuff and retreat.
Yes.
I don't know about performing there again. Maybe.
Oh, ooh.
Is it a place where you could try stuff out? Or do you think if you've been off the telly, you'd be there'd be too much attention? That's the tricky thing.
This is the thing. In theory, it's a great place to try things out.
Yeah.
And probably there must be people who have been off from the telly and tried stuff out. And then gone, it's okay, just trying stuff out. It's Edinburgh.
Yeah, I don't know. I have such fond memories. So the thing is, I went for 10 years.
Right. 10 years, isn't it?
I was really struggling to get work. So it's sort of a really... The memory is both wonderful and... tough.
Like,
thinking, is this ever going to happen? And trying to get people's attention, and agents saying they're coming and they won't, and doing all press, and you know, the memories are quite.
I do remember seeing your posters and flyers and things up there. I was going to say show. I didn't see the show, unfortunately.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
But sorry to rub that in.
Three people in every day. You didn't.
But I remember knowing of you as an Edinburgh Fringe regular.
Well, that's the thing. It does help get your name within the industry.
Mm.
You become, even like you say, even if people don't see your show, then you're like going, "Hi, I'm trying to get into comedy."
That's true. That's true.
By putting my poster up. I think I had a quote one year from Arabella Weir, which really helped.
Oh, okay, yes.
Who I'd met on an advert. And all that kind of thing, you're just constantly building a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And then, because then you did Hyperdrive and things like
Hyperdrive.
That.
Hyperdrive. That was my first main role. That's when I could give up temping.
Right.
And I haven't had to temp since, which I'm very lucky.
Hyperdrive, an underrated sci-fi sitcom from several years ago. You know, I watched Hyperdrive, and we were just starting to write series one of Not Going Out at the time, and I was there with Lee Mack, who was writing it but also casting at the same time. He said, "We need a funny guest actor as an acupuncturist," and I suggested Miranda, who I'd seen in Hyperdrive, and she got the part, became a regular on Not Going Out, and the rest is history. I'm taking full responsibility, basically, for that little corner of her TV success. Apart from, it's all her, basically, but, you know, it's nice to have a hand in these things. Now, from the TV sci-fi of Hyperdrive to Star Trek, one I've never actually seen. I've never actually seen any Star Trek. I've seen a couple of the films, all right. No, I've seen none of the films. I've seen Spaceballs. That's what I've seen. I've seen Spaceballs. Much to the shock of my old pal, Henry Kendall, who is, I think it's fair to say, a bit of a Star Trek fan. And he's in a very noisy corner of the club. So do bear with us. We're only chatting for a minute or so.
Why should we watch Star Trek?
Because it is bringing out everything that is good in humanity. In the world that surrounds us that is trying to drag us into the Dark Ages, it is a shining beacon of what we can be.
And if I wanted to go, I've never seen Star Trek as a TV series.
Yes, do you start?
So where do I begin?
Well, it's too long, because there's getting off of 550 hours worth of TV and films. What you should do is start at the beginning, and start with the original series, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Enterprise, and just watch it all.
Best episode ever?
Best episode ever, unequivocally, Best of Both Worlds. It's a two-parter spanning the end of season 3 and season 4 of Star Trek Next Generation, where Captain Picard is abducted and transformed into a binary zombie with hilarious consequences. It is the best episode. And the best film is Star Trek Nemesis. There is your recommended reading for Star Trek.
Very good.
Well, it's time for our regular bring a bottle moment. It's only polite to bring something to the party. If not a bottle, then maybe something else. In previous weeks, we've asked you to rate us on iTunes or join our Facebook group or buy a book from one of our many guests. This week, we are asking if you would give something back to us. The one week we're going to ask. We will only ever ask you one episode per series, and this is series one. If you would consider pinging us some dosh. We do now have a donate button. It's on the right-hand side of the page of each episode, if you're looking at it on heptagonclub.co.uk, where it's hosted there via Podbean. So it's not on the iTunes version, but the non-iTunes website version does. If you would consider donating to us, by which I mean me, because there's no one else, it's just me, which makes it all the more needy, really, to have a bit of help if you'd consider pinging some pound my way. Because this has cost me money, not just for hosting this online, which costs a fair quid, but also a fair amount of travel. I know all of the guests are housed in this wonderful seven-sided club that we're in. but in most cases, I have also, some reason, had to visit their houses across the land for administrative purposes. So all that travel, I am a bit out of pocket with this podcast, which is fine. I don't mind doing that. But I'm not asking for the earth. But if you have enjoyed it and fancy bunging over whatever, a pound an episode or, you know, a tenner for the whole series of seven episodes, if you really enjoy it, that would be fantastic. More, of course, if you particularly want to keep us afloat, in which case you earn the right to a name check if you would like it, and you become a Heptagon Club life peer. Yes, we will call you Lord or Lady, whichever your preference. If you can go into double figures, that would be definitely a promise we would keep to you. We only have one more episode this series. Each series has seven episodes for some coincidental reason. So a series two will appear later in the year, hopefully. Basically, I'll be far more inclined to get it made sooner and faster if anyone has chucked in some coin our way. So if you would care to donate, you'll be ushering along Series 2 all the quicker. Heptagonclub.co.uk and then the donate button on the right if you would consider You Star You. Thank you very much. Now, our seventh guest this week is a comedian you probably won't have heard of unless you're Australian and possibly from Perth. He's a stand-up, he's an improviser, and he's a full-time priest. So, Father Chris Bedding.
Yeah, hi, it's great to be with
you. Thank you for being here and in this country, because you're not from this country, are you?
No, I'm an Australian. I live in Perth, right. Western Australia, but I was raised in Sydney, okay. Which is on the East Coast. I've lived in Perth for 7 years, and in that 7 years, Perth has improved dramatically.
Right.
We now have in Perth the world's third largest fringe festival.
Yes.
So if you're a fringe performer, and I'm not just saying this, if you're looking for a place to perform, come to Fringe World Festival in Perth. It will blow your mind.
Because you are, your title is Father Chris Bedding, so presumably that's, are a father.
I'm an actual priest, priest. An Anglican priest. You have to always clarify that.
An Anglican priest. And a performer. You are.
Yeah, so I'm a stand-up comedian, so I work the local circuit. I don't do a lot of outside of my own state because it's hard to tour the vicar. And what else do I do? I'm an improviser. So,
right, okay. Does that include sermons?
I do not improvise sermons.
No.
See, here's the problem. When you're a comedy priest, people are like, I must come to your church sometime. And I say, if you're looking for a laugh, don't bother because that's not, I'm not trying that out. Yeah. And nobody likes... maybe they do, but I don't want to be that clergyman who's doing gags on Sunday morning.
Yeah. So which came first for you then? Is it?
I was a priest first. So right, I was stupid young when I was ordained. So I was a deacon at 23.
Right.
So I was in... My first ministry job was at 19.
Right.
So I went into ministry stupid young because everyone said to me... go and get life experience. Go and get life experience. And you know what? You get actually more life experience in the first week in this job than you do. Like waiting tables or, backpacking through Europe is all very nice.
Yeah.
But actually, you want life experience. Become a priest when you're really young. And also learn how to deal with a lot of idiots.
Right.
Like a lot of idiots.
Right.
That's probably the key qualification for the modern day priest, dealing with idiots. And beautiful, wise, kind people
of course,
as well. But a lot of you.
That's a nice bit of rare wisdom to get, Be prepared to deal with idiots. You don't hear that often enough.
That's true.
When you're doing the stand-up or the improv type things, how did you get into it? What did you think?
I'd always said, you cannot combine being a priest and stand-up comedy. You just cannot do that. But I was doing a short-term job working for the Ecumenical Movement. And I thought, now is the time. So I went and did a competition. And then as I started to get a bit of profile and started doing some radio work, I was like, maybe I should talk to the bishop about this.
Right, okay, yeah.
Sort of sound him out.
Yeah.
And then this is true. Then I went, no, I'm not going to do that. It's I'm actually just going to pretend like this is really normal and like nothing's odd about this. And it's funny because I have an archbishop and an area bishop, and none of them have even ever raised the issue.
Right.
Even when I've done like TV and stuff, they're like, they just don't.
Great.
It's kind of like I have a disease or something they're too polite to mention it.
Yeah. Father Chris Bedding there. Two more vicars next week, in fact, in Reverends Kate Botley and Richard Coles, both stars of the telly box, like many of the people still buzzing around this week, including Milton.
I think to people who do stand-up, quite often there's an element of there isn't really much else I could do. You have to be desperate enough. We know all the people like John Bishop and Dave Spikey who had proper jobs.
Yes.
And it took them longer to make the jump.
Yeah.
And... there's something about having to do it that makes you get on and do it. And having kids and stuff like that, you suddenly think, right, this has got to work now.
Yeah,
right?
True.
I need to make this happen. And I often compare it to doing going into rugby tackle. If you go in going, oh dear, this might hurt, you will get hurt.
Right.
But if you just give it 100%, you may break your next tree, but more often than not, it won't hurt because you're so committed to winning the ball that you barely notice the pain.
Yes.
So I think the same is sort of true of stand-up.
I did not write this joke.
Okay.
I taught a comedy workshop with a gifted and talented program in a school, in a state school, where students opted in to do a comedy program. Mm. And I was brought in as the guest kind of tutor for a couple of weeks. And this little boy, who is about 9, whose name is Drew, right, wrote this joke.
Okay.
And I think it's one of the best jokes.
Okay, hit me.
That I have heard.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
What,
yep,
is a pixie's favourite drink?
What is a pixie's favourite drink? I do not know. What is a pixie's favourite drink?
Sprite.
Oh, ooh, that's oh.
You see how clever that joke,
I know,
is,
it is
for an 8-year-old.
That's good.
Yeah,
isn't it?
That and is good. I, it took me. I did that moment where I went, oh my god! Yeah, oh, nice.
I went to the Goblin Library. I said, "Where do you keep your books?" He said, "Shh, elves." But I've got another one of I was in this hospital and I saw this pixie and he was elated. Well, he was pixelated, so I couldn't see his face. That's a little extra one. I said, are you here to give blood? He said, I'm not allowed to give blood. I said, why not? He said, I've got too much hemoglobin.
Well, you've got one more visit now to the very noisy corner, but bear with it for just a minute, where my friend Henry resides, quietly judging the dress sense of all of our guests.
Henry Kendall.
Yes.
What trousers are you wearing?
I'm not wearing jeans.
How many people here are wearing jeans?
98%.
That's a lot of people. Why should we be not wearing jeans?
Well, I think, as ever with these things, you have to look at it in historical context.
Right.
The garment itself, presumably, begins life as a utilitarian type garment. One would have to acknowledge this fact, considering how many people wear them. They must be easy to wear, comfortable, go with everything. I would probably say go with nothing.
So that's good, isn't it? There's good reasons for jeans.
Those are good reasons, but they seem to rub up oppositely to what seems to be the modern phenomenon of wanting to differentiate yourself very slightly, but also basically.
So individuality and expressionism and whatever.
And people want to do that, and they do it within a controlled environment, but they do it, and the top half is very different. But men and women, it transcends the gender. Men and women are doing this gene thing all over the place, and they're basically all the same. Skinny, but
is that how are we expressing individuality then, through skinny boot cuts?
Well, that's the only way of doing it.
Because, what I mean, what jean do you wear?
You're suddenly limited by colour because basically they've got to be blue or incremental shades around that. So it's a skinny or not.
What do you think to a red jean? Surely a red jean is a mark of so individual that it's a little bit wacky. Is it too much?
The less said about them, the better. And you don't see it much, and there's a shining good reason.
But in that case, surely a blue jean is better than than going too crazy with the jean colour, isn't it?
In that a blue jean is better than being stabbed in the face.
Okay, fair enough.
But I encourage all listeners to look about them underneath the waist.
Okay.
Whenever they're in public places, because it is quite extraordinary the uniformity, and uniform is a good word to use, the uniform of the 21st century person, male or female, that is so common.
If we wore jeans on our top half, it'd be more individual.
Well, if everyone was wearing denim shirts of varying slight shades of blue or tights or billowing, it would look extremely strange.
Sorry, Henry, there are plenty of jeans at this party, including in a mo. Our theme tune is called Blue Jeans, which is very inappropriate given your hatred for that particular trouser. Rob Halligan's theme tune always concludes our party.
I do like parties, and I like this one particularly. Do you know what I like? It's that lovely hubbub you get at parties. And I can hear it now, just all around me. I love it. Mm. Great. And the sort of clink of wine glasses. I got home the other day, actually, my horse was drinking a glass of wine. I said, what's that? He said, it's a Chardonnay. But yes, that's why I like the hubbub. It sort of covers me with a laugh.
That's absolutely fine. That's
There's more hubbub next week. Thanks to all my guests this week. Sally Phillips, Milton Jones, Tim Vine, Miranda Hart, Henry Kendall, my wife, Father Chris Bedding, who has a double act show called Pirate Church. It's pirates doing church, I think. And that has toured Australia. He'd love to make it international. If anyone fancies a gander at that, have a Google. Speaking of which, thank you to Premier Christianity magazine and podcast for helping us with the Milton and Sally chat. Do Google them. You can get a free copy of their magazine. And further, speaking of church and clergy and things, next week our final episode of the series has two vicars, possibly our two most well-known, certainly via the telly box. That's Reverends Richard Coles and Kate Botley, plus a Muslim writer and speaker actor Abdul Rahman Malik, comedians like Juliet Burton, all are on our final episode of this 7-episode run. Hey, has anybody said to you today? But for now, our theme music, Rob Halligan's Blue Jeans. Sorry, Henry, I didn't really like Blue Jeans earlier, but that's different. Do rate us on iTunes if you can. Join our Facebook group. Give, donate if you are able. Fancy chucking us something for our trouble. And may I be the very last to wish you a happy new year. I'm sure I won't be the last. There's always one or two in February or March. Just can't resist. Bye!